you cast your mind back, a few weeks ago, we were looking at Job and his friends. And one of the things I think we agree, and is notable, that when people take a strong side in argument and get passionate about it, they can actually get quite unbalanced as well. While I was thinking about this today, my mind went back to a friend of my parents. We used to call him Uncle Chris. And they were friends because they'd started in the profession of teaching at the same time. And so really, as I was growing up, we sort of grew up with his family, and we often used to go over and spend time with them as a family. Now, he was Welsh, and he loved to argue. Now, he would argue almost for the sake of arguing. And my father had a theory, which I think was almost true. I mean, he must say the most outrageous things. My mother used to say that when my brother Peter was ill, was younger, he was quite ill with asthma, and therefore didn't speak a great deal. But he would get so incensed with what Chris was saying that he would actually join in the conversation because he was coming out with such ludicrous things. There was nothing off-beam for him. He would make up facts, he would make up statistics. And my father had the theory, as I was about to say, that if you were clever enough, you could literally work him round to the other point of view that he'd started arguing against, so that he'd then start arguing for that. And to be fair, we've almost seen that with Job's friends, haven't we? If you think of Eliphaz, Eliphaz actually starts by commending Job. He speaks about the charity that Job has shown to others who are destitute, who have fallen on hard times. But by the time we get to the end of Eliphaz's speeches, he's virtually gone from that to saying, Job, you're about the greatest sinner that has ever walked on God's green earth. Such is the attitude we see. Well, last week we got well away from that, and we took an interlude, didn't we, as we looked at chapter 28. And as I said, my theory has been, and it's the theory of others, I'm glad to say, that the person who has compiled the book has almost said, well, hold on a second, this is getting a bit bruising. We desperately need some fresh air. Let's open a window, as metaphorically, as to where real wisdom comes from, where true wisdom can be found. And the conclusion was this: wisdom is found in the fear of the Lord. True wisdom is found there. And to shun evil doing, that's understanding. That's where wisdom begins. So it might seem a bit surprised that after that we have Job continuing to speak, although his target seems to be more in that he's speaking to God now rather than his friends. And then we might be surprised after he's sort of come to an end that suddenly someone else speaks up. Enter Elihu. Now, Elihu's a new voice. We don't quite know when he sort of come onto the scene, but he seems to have been there for some time. And he's a young man. We gather that, don't we, from chapter 32. He's weighted, he's respectful to his elders, but he's got a real problem. He doesn't feel that Job's friends have really dealt with Job sufficiently, and he's annoyed. You know, one of the good things sometimes about youth is this, that there is a love of justice, isn't there? And he sees Job as being condemned, but he doesn't feel they've adequately made a case to condemn Job. And he's also rather annoyed at Job, because he's seen himself justifying himself rather than God. Job's argument, it could be summed up, if you look at 31 and verse 1, he started to appeal to the fact that he is a morally upright person. There's this business, isn't there, about guarding his eyes, behaving himself. I've made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. He has gone on to say, hasn't he, that if he has sinned, then fair enough. If he's visibly sinned, then he should be punished by it. Verse 9 to 11, if my heart has been enticed by a woman or I've lurked at my neighbour's door. That would be fair enough. Now, one of the things we do have to remember is that actually, whatever anyone else says, Job has never actually claimed to be perfect. But what he's saying is that visibly he stands as morally upright. What is also interesting is this. Elihu does seem to have listened somewhat to what Job has said. One of the big faults of the friends, I believe, is this. They tend to have an agenda. Most of them. Zophar certainly does. He's had a big mystical experience, so he thinks it must have some bearing on Job's suffering. And so very often they start talking from that agenda, and basically, just to throw a blanket over the whole lot, we could say that their main agenda tends to be the wisdom of the day. Good deeds lead to blessing from God. Bad deeds or sin, hidden or otherwise, it will be found out. God will punish it. And that's been the issue. Literally from the time they started with Job. Now Elihu, to be fair, has listened. He's listened to Job's complaint. Now Job's main complaint is that if he's being judged by God, if there is something in his life, then his punishment is disproportionate. And we have to remember this. We do have insider knowledge, don't we? We know why Job's suffering, but Job does not. But he listens to Job. He certainly listens to certain snippets of what he said. Chapter 27, verse 2. This is important. As surely as the Lord lives, who has denied me justice, denied me justice, the mighty has made me taste bitterness of the soul. The point is this, that he doesn't deserve what's happening to him. He's veering very close to calling God unjust. I think it's be fair, he hasn't quite crossed that line. He's saying that God is withholding justice from him. But that is an issue. And again, he actually does deal with Job's complaint. In 31 verse 35, Job has sort of come towards the end of his words and said, "Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing." Dicament in writing. And now, Elihu has several things to say. Now I've got 4 points concerning Elihu. And the first is this. Elihu insists that God is not silent. Now we're looking at chapter 33 here. Now his basic argument is this, that he speaks whether we are listening or not. Verses 12 to 14. But now I tell you, in this you are not right, for God is greater than man. Why do you complain to him that he answers none of man's words? That's, of course, one of Job's complaints. For God does speak, now one way, now another, though a man may not perceive it. And then he goes on to list the ways in which God can speak. In a way, he's very much answering the accusations of Job. He's actually answering, and he's quoted it in verse 8 through to 11, but Job has sort of basically argued that he is morally upright, he has not visibly sinned. And the argument is this: God will not then prevent justice or hold back justice. He will act. That's what verse 12 stated. So there's a purpose to what God is doing. But what is the purpose? Well, Elihu says it is to warn us. And he lists various ways, verse 15, in a dream. Verse 16, probably here using Job's experience, by some calamity. What's the purpose? Well, it's to turn man from wrongdoing, to keep him from from pride. Now, Elihu is, I think, by far in many ways the most compassionate of the speakers. Now, this could be because he doesn't get into a barney with Job. Job is strangely silent at this point in the narrative, and there are several reasons why that may be so. Elphus touched on God's corrective punishment. Back in chapter 5, he says this, chapter 5, verse 18, verse 17, "Blessed is the man who God corrects, so do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands heal." But Elihu is more explicit in what is happening here. His argument, as I said, is that it can be corrective. Verse 19, "A man may be chastened on a bed of pain, with constant distress in his bones, so that he finds foods repulsive. His soul loathes choice meal, his flesh wastes away. To nothing, his bones once hidden stick out. His soul draws near to the pit, his life to the messengers of death." But then he puts a but in. It's not just God goading him that way. It's this: "Yet, if there's an angel on his side, a mediator, one in a thousand, to tell a man what's right for him, to be gracious to him and say, spare him from going down to the pit, I have found a ransom for him." Elihu argues that there can be some intervention in the suffering which will draw people back to focus on God. Now, let me just say before we go too far on this, I believe pastorally one of the worst things that can be said to a person when they're going through a very bad time is, "Have you thought about what God is teaching you through this?" He may well be, but one has to pitch that question at the appropriate time. Because the one thing that's clear from the book of Job is that we can very often be in a situation where we have no idea what happened, what is happening. Many people said, and I remember this very well, and I remember my mother's answer, when my brother Peter died, many people said to Mum, "It's so hard to know why." And Mum's answer really was, "I don't really see that we should ever know why." It happens. That, I think, is mature Christian understanding. It's a damaged world. The Lord's people suffer. We've been looking at Psalms. We see numerous examples of it. And Job is an example of suffering where you can't really see a great deal of purpose in it. Just think of the sufferings of people like Jeremiah. He's completely sort of in the midst of sort of a whirlwind of what's going on. He's the Lord's prophet. My word, it's a thankless task for the poor guy. And, you know, very often he's almost accusing the Lord and saying, well, you led me down this path in the first place. I gave the prophecy. Why has this now got to happen to me? I did what you wanted. You know, sometimes, we saw this in the book of Acts. My word, if we can't learn this from there, where can we? Was there anything wrong in what Paul was doing? No, he was preaching the gospel. It was good, wasn't it? Yet he's continually chased out of town, beaten up, goodness knows what. That is the plight very often, isn't it, for the Lord's people. They will suffer for doing the Lord's will. So Elihu is listening, but perhaps he goes into a dangerous thing. But he does make this point, doesn't he? God can intervene through suffering, and that is undoubtedly true. His argument, I see, would be summed up basically this way. Whatever the circumstances are, the nature of God is loving. And if he is falling slightly, and we see that Elihu does do this, tending towards the wisdom of the age, then he's a bit more sympathetic and he's listened that little bit more. Proverbs, of course, is mentioned. This Proverbs 3, 11 to 12 is mentioned in Hebrews. It is about discipline, corrective discipline, or discipline that shapes character. And it's this comment in chapter 3. Verse 11, my son, do not despise the Lord's discipline, do not resent his rebuke. Because the Lord disciplines those he loves, as a father, the son he delights in. Now Hebrews goes into great detail on that, doesn't it? It mentions, doesn't it, that actually we know we're the Lord's if we are disciplined by him. And one of the things we have to remember, not always the case, but one of the many times discipline is brought up in Proverbs, and indeed, I believe generally in Hebrews, it is not about necessarily corrective discipline. It is discipline that shapes character. It is discipline to see how we respond and whether we will grow. And that can be the case, can't it? But when speaking to people who are in the midst of it, we need to use a great deal of discretion and wisdom. Now, secondly, Elihu attempts to deal with Job's complaint, and this is where Elihu, in my opinion, scores big. He has listened. Now we're in chapter 34 now. Now, notice this, verse 5. Job says, I am innocent, but the Lord has denied me justice. He's got the gist of it, I think. I think what Job has generally said is that God is withholding justice, that there's a sense in which he's, as I said, morally upright and his punishment is disproportionate. But at least he's listened, because that's more than I think the friends have done. Now, he now starts to deal with that. He also picks up on something else, which is interesting, because it kind of focuses us to Satan's temptation and Satan's whole process. Verse 9 of chapter 34, he says, it profits a man nothing when he tries to please God. Now, there's a question that we've been looking at in the book of Job, and this is good here because it reminds us of it, is the Lord worthy of worship no matter what? Because Satan's very commercially minded approach is, well, Job only worships you because of what he's getting out of it. And then, it wasn't a proper test. If his health remains, well, you know, it's still okay. He's still kind of being looked after by you. Take that away and you are not worth his worship. Now, again, Job has very much pleaded his case, and perhaps that's a rather neat and slightly trite way of summing it up. But it does prove again, as I said, that he's listened. So Elihu now seeks to deal with that. He argues that God will not prevent justice. Verse 11 and 12. He repays a man for what he has done. He brings upon him what his conduct deserves. It is unthinkable that God would do wrong, that the Almighty would pervert justice. Now, some of that's good and some of that's questionable. True, God will not pervert justice. We're going to come on to that big time because I think it's a key part of the last part of the book. Is God just? But again, he's lapsing into the thinking of the age. And the thinking is, again, that good deeds deserve blessing, bad deserve punishment. And so they're still erring on the idea that Job must have done something. But he also gets a vaster picture here. He notes this, doesn't he? That God has control over all things, and that again is important for Job to hear. Verse 13, who has appointed him over the earth? Who put him in charge of the whole world? It's a rhetorical question. Of course, no one has. It's God's in the first place. If it were his intention, and he withdrew his spirit and breath, all mankind would perish together, and man would return to the dust. Again, that's important, isn't it? God literally has that control over each and every one of us. One of the things that's been commented on this year is that so many famous people and so many people in the music world have died. And of course, you know, quite great shock to many people when the artist called Prince died this week, and again, comparatively really young. But whatever the how, whys and wherefores of this, it demonstrates one thing, doesn't it? Doesn't matter how famous you are. Doesn't matter how much money you've got or how much supposed talent you've got. When your time's up, your time's up. God's numbered your days and that's it. Doesn't matter whether people know you or don't know you. And certainly, Elihu dresses that. Again, he comes to an important point in verse 19. Who shows no partiality to princes and does not favour the rich over the poor. Now, that again is very important. And actually, one of the things I think is interesting, if we're actually looking, there's a lot of talk in the when we look at wisdom literature, that it sort of stands outside of covenant theology. But that's very, very close to sort of covenant thinking, isn't it? What was the key thing? Do you remember in Deuteronomy 1 when Moses is to appoint judges? They weren't to be swayed, were they? They were to reflect God's character. Just because someone came to them with a case and they had a load of money didn't make that case more important than someone who came to them who had no money. It was being impartial. They weren't to be bought. They weren't to be impressed by who a person was. And God is that. But there is a weakness. He's tackling Job's concern, but he misses the point. He's right when he says in verse 35, Job speaks without knowledge, his words lack insight. But he cannot say for sure, and he has no inkling of what the issue is. Just look at 37, he's lapsing back to the wisdom of the day. To his sin he adds rebellion. Scornfully he claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. In other words, Job has done something, and because he's protesting his innocence, he's making it worse for himself. That is the wisdom of the age. So Elihu insists God is not silent. Elihu attempts to deal with Job's complaint. That's good. Elihu is very eloquent, third point, but he gets carried away. Now, this is the point where in chapter 35, you get the impression that he's getting carried away by his own eloquence. He almost... This is a very interesting chapter. And it's one of these chapters you keep coming at and trying to look at from different angles, because you sort of think you know what he's saying, but you're trying to get your head exactly around what he is saying, because he's kind of gives the impression that God is so great and so mighty. Yes, no problem with that. Why would it bother him what Job does? Now, to me, that completely undermines the argument of everything that's gone before. That actually asks the question why everything is happening in the first place, why Job is protesting his innocence. But just listen to verse 5 of that chapter. Look up at the heavens and see. Gaze at the clouds so high above you. If you sin, how does that affect him? If your sins are many, what does that do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give to him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Now, it's kind of one of those things you can look at that in the sense that it's good, because it sort of says, well, you know, how good can we be? Our righteousness is never sufficient. It isn't, but of course we are looking at this from the point of view of wisdom, and we're not looking at it from the view of covenant theology. So that make a very good New Testament argument, but it's a bit lost here. But he does seem to say, isn't it, that in the end, how can God be bothered by what you do? Again, verse 16, he accuses Job of opening his mouth with empty talk, with words without knowledge. He multiplies words. This is a subject that he's touched on before. Now, what the problem is now happening is tending to make the friend's mistake, because he starts again to open up on his own agenda. And one of the problems with Elihu's speeches now, if you were to read, and I do recommend, do read these chapters 32 to 37, because they're worth reading, is that he tends to reflect all that the friends have said before. He does add some new stuff, as we've said, but now it tends to get repetitive. Why is this? Why should we have it again? Well, I think there's several reasons why Elihu's speeches continue in the vein they do. And one of this, it is a bit of a refresher to us. Or maybe it's not a refresher. Depends how you look on the speeches. He is reminding us of so much that's been said so far. And that's going to be important, isn't it? Because in a minute, literally next week, we're going to get God's take on the whole thing. So in a sense, he's reiterating what man's wisdom is and where it falls short. He has a weakness, as the friends did. Do you remember the friends used to use, Eliphaz used the phrase, we have examined this. This is the wisdom teachers of the day. Here's Elihu's weakness. Just take a listen to a few things that have been scattered about as we've gone through his speeches. And just a hint in chapter 33, verse 33. But if not, then listen to me. Be silent. I will teach you wisdom. And there's the first thought. He's appealing to the wisdom of the day, as we said. Verse 34. He comes out with this in verse 2 and 3. Hear my words, you wise men. Listen to me, you men of learning. For the ear tests words as the tongue distastes food. Nothing particularly wrong in that, but you do feel he's getting a little bit fond of his own voice. Now, here's the one I think that really sort of takes the biscuit and shows you that he has a rather inflated view. Verse 36. He said this, I'm sure, with a straight face, but how he did it, I don't know. Elihu continued, this is verse 1, 36, bear with me a little longer, and I will show you that there's more to be said on God's behalf. And we're thinking, good, yeah, that's fine, no problem. I get my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe justice to my maker. We'll say, okay, fine, yeah, that's all right. Here's the bit. Be assured my words are not false. One perfect in knowledge is with you. Now, I don't believe that's referring to the Lord's wisdom. That is the arrogance, I believe, of youth. There are many good things, but he has perhaps got a little bit fond of his own voice. And as I said, he's fallen back on the wisdom of the age, 36, verses 13 and 14. What he's saying there, you can read them yourself, is basically the same as we said before. The wicked get what they deserve. God finds them out, he tracks them down. They will suffer. And Job is a sinner. Verse 17 of 36, but now you are laden with judgment due to the wicked. Judgment and justice have taken hold of you. So it's back really where we were before. But Elihu has something more to say, and this is all good. And it's this. It's my fourth point. Elihu has a very important use here. He is preparing us for the climax of the book, when God will speak. There's a shift. Suddenly he gets away from his wisdom and he starts to reflect on God. And that's always got to be a good thing, hasn't it? Chapter 36, we suddenly get a shift in his thinking. Listen to this, because it's good. Verse 22. And 23. God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? Who has prescribed his ways for him? Or said to him, you have done wrong? There's a reflection there, isn't there, that God is the source of perfect wisdom, which is not able to be questioned, because no one can actually step up and question God's wisdom. This is the ultimate of wisdom. He has more to say on that, and he starts to, it's very interesting this, he starts to describe what seems to be happening. He talks in terms of rainfall. He talks in terms of a storm coming. That's very interesting, because what's going to happen when God speaks? Well, he speaks, doesn't he, out of the whirlwind or out of the storm. Chapter 37, he's literally saying to Job, stand back and consider God. Just see how he starts the chapter. At this my heart pounds and leaps from its place. Listen to the roar of his voice, the rumble that comes from his mouth. He unleashes his lightning beneath the whole heaven. He sends it to the ends of the earth. There's something, isn't there, fantastic about the majesty and greatness of God there. There's more. This is great stuff, isn't it? Verse 5, God's voice thunders in marvelous ways. He does great things beyond our understanding. In a sense, we could have done it with a bit more of this, couldn't we, throughout these speeches. He's talking, isn't he, verse 6, 7, here, about how he's got control over the earth and all of creation. And he asks Job, doesn't he, to stand back, consider. Verse 14 to 16, listen to this, Job. Stop and consider God's wonders. Do you know how God controls the crowds and makes his lightning flash? Do you know how the crowds hang poised? Those wonders of him who is perfect in knowledge? Now, this is interesting because, as I've said, next chapter God will speak. And Elihu's questions to Job are preparing Job and preparing us for that. Now, I think we'll all agree Elihu's had some good things to say. He has listened. He has said some sensible things. He might have been a bit pompous now and again. He might have got carried away with his own eloquence, but at least in the end, he reflects on who God is and on the majesty of God. And he asked Job to do that. And of course, the time we focus on God, we've seen this morning as we looked at Psalm 42, is when we're at our best. What's the psalmist's problem this morning? Well, he looked back to the good times, going up to worship God and have fellowship and how they're all joyous and everything like that, and it made him miserable because that wasn't where he was at. But when he started to reflect on God, as we said at the end of the psalm and as it goes into Psalm 43, he starts to climb out of that situation. And whatever our circumstances, that is what we've got to do. One of the most important things, I think, in counselling, really, whatever it is, whatever I do, now I do this to different degrees with different people. If I'm going to a family that are not Christians, for a funeral, obviously, the approach has to be perhaps a bit more gentle. I want people to reflect and look to God, because he is the source, isn't he, of all comfort. And the source of all knowledge. And if we sort of look at Elihu and say, yeah, perhaps he's the best, well, we have to commend him, don't we, on the way he ends. He's asking Job to consider. He's building to a climax, for the ultimate climax of the book, and that is the voice of God. In the end, Elihu shows us the best and the worst, the wisdom and the folly that man is capable of. But most importantly, he prepares us for God to speak. I used this, I think, when we were looking at the other speeches, and perhaps last week, I can't remember, but what does Paul say? Well, Paul's using this extreme sort of form of Jewish teaching that they used to do. Extreme example. It's not that he thinks God is foolish. But he's saying, you know, even if God was foolish, it would be far more wise than the wisdom of man. I'm going to end with 1 Corinthians 1, verses 20 to 25. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what is preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs. Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God, the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Now, do you know, I find that incredibly encouraging. Because that literally says that the foolishness of what is preached, in my frail words, or any person's frail words, God can use it. Because the source of all wisdom is God. And as I said, Paul is not saying God is foolish, but if God was foolish, it would still be far wiser than man's wisdom. Let's take the best of Elihu and look to God in all we seek to do. And look to the ultimate wisdom of God. The wisdom, or as some people saw it, the foolishness of the cross. Because actually the greatest need, all human need, is solved in forgiveness of sins, which Christ has made possible. Let's pray.